Good morning. The famous Olivet Discourse, it's found in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, is said to be pivotal to a proper understanding of Bible prophecy. In it we find mention of wars and rumors of wars, famines, earthquakes, persecution of the saints, the Great Tribulation, and the coming of the Son of Man. It is in the Olivet Discourse that Jesus says, "Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be found worthy to escape all these things that are coming to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." The exhortation to watch has been taken to mean that we're to read Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report and watch CNN and Fox News and all of that stuff, and that's what it means to watch. That's not what it means at all. It does not mean that. In fact, you can fulfill this exhortation to watch even if you're living on a desert island and are cut off from the rest of the world and don't even know what's going on. What it means is, the same word is rendered elsewhere, be vigilant. Be vigilant. It means that to be in a continuous state of preparedness. And that's one of the important themes of Matthew 24. We're going to take a look at this chapter today. It means to be in a state of constant state of preparedness regardless of what is going on in the world around you. Even if it doesn't look like Christ's coming is very soon, even if it's a time of peace, you still be in a constant state of preparedness. No matter what the conditions are, you be ready always. That's the point he's making here, and that's the meaning of watch. Now, understand, I'm not saying don't watch world events. I'm not telling you not to look at what's going on in the Middle East. I take a keen interest in that. I take a keen interest in what is going on in Iraq, and what is going on in the Middle East, and what the European Union is doing. All of those things are important, and I keep an eye on them. But that's not what Jesus means here when he says watch. He's saying be prepared at all times. And we're going to get into Matthew 24, and we're going to see exactly what he has in mind. Today I want to look at Matthew 24, and I want to offer some new perspectives, perhaps, new to some of us, on the meaning and the main theme of this chapter. A little bit different for some of us, and yet at the same time, it doesn't contradict any doctrine that I know of in the Church of God. So I'm not teaching new doctrine. I'm giving you a little bit different perspective, and I believe perhaps a better understanding of the intent of Matthew 24, what it's all about. First, let's get to the contextual background of Matthew 24 by looking back at Matthew 23. Matthew chapter 23 lays the foundation. It sets the background for going into Matthew 24 so that we can see what Jesus is talking about. In Matthew 23, we see one of the most scathing rebukes against the scribes and the Pharisees that you can imagine. The language is precise. It's definite. There's no question as to what Jesus is saying. He is condemning the religious leaders. Not all of them, of course, but so many of them. He again and again says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." Very strong language. He calls them blind guides, children of hell. All these terms he uses, and as I said, very strong language in condemning these people for their approach to things, their lack of repentance, their lack of conversion, their lack of genuine righteousness. And to get on over to, let's start on over in verse 31, and you can read the whole chapter for yourself and see what a scathing rebuke that this is against the scribes and the Pharisees. But just kind of summarizing from verse 31 down to the end of the chapter, he says, "Therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets." Back in verse 30, he says, "You say that if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets." You know, you go back to the Old Testament, you see what happened. What did the people do when God sent prophets to them? Well, they persecuted them. In some cases, they killed them. And the scribes and Pharisees say, "Oh, that wouldn't have been us. No, we would have been on the side of the prophets." And Jesus is saying, "No, you would not. You are the sons of those who killed the prophets. And you're going to do the same thing your fathers did." This is what he's saying here. "Therefore," again, verse 31, "therefore you are witnesses against yourselves that you are the sons of those who have murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt." Go ahead, do what your fathers did. Make it complete. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of Gehenna? Therefore, indeed, I send you prophets and wise men and scribes. In other words, the apostles and the evangelists. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city. That on you, now listen to this, this is very important in order to establish the background, the foundation for understanding Matthew 24. It says that on you, you scribes, you Pharisees, and all of you who follow in their ways, on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. He says, assuredly I say to you, all these things, all what things? He's talking about the things associated with divine wrath. Just like your fathers received, you too will be the recipients of divine wrath for your disobedience. Just as they killed the prophets, so you will kill the prophets that I send to you, and divine wrath will befall you. Assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon not some future generation, not some 20th century generation, but upon this generation. And I'm telling you, it did come upon that generation. It happened from the years AD 66 to AD 70, after a sufficient witness had been given to those people. And the armies of General Titus came in and destroyed the temple. They besieged Jerusalem. And it was indeed one of the greatest times of turmoil for that city of all history. In fact, the greatest, many would say. And I believe that because I believe that's what Jesus says here, as we're going to see in a few moments. So these people were the recipients of divine wrath because just as their fathers before them, they killed the prophets who were sent to them. In this case, it was the apostles, the evangelists, the members of God's church that they persecuted and drove from city to city and threw out of their synagogues and in some cases stoned to death and crucified and so on. And then he says, verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. In other words, it's coming down. The temple will be destroyed. Your city will be besieged. The blessings you could have had through obedience to the law God gave you, it's all coming to an end because you're not obedient. You're killing the ones who are sent to you. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, this is the backdrop. It's important to understand this and the covenant wrath, the divine wrath that is to befall Jerusalem for their sins, for their iniquity, their persecution of the true saints that God sends to them. Of course, beginning with Jesus, they killed him. And then he killed his followers, those who went out preaching in Jesus' name. You know, they persecuted them. That's what Jesus is talking about. And he's saying, for this reason, wrath is coming upon you. So this is the background. Now let's go into Matthew 24 and see what he's talking about here. It says, then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and the disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And indeed, that happened. It's not talking about that foundational wall that's still standing. It's talking about the temple proper. Every stone was thrown down. Everything was removed from its place. The temple is destroyed. It's not there, is it? You see that mosque there in its place, but you don't see the temple. Now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? What things? Well, the destruction of the temple, the siege on Jerusalem, and so on. The things he's just been talking about. Divine wrath. And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? I want to point out to you that there are two questions here, really. First of all, when will these things be? Divine wrath upon Jerusalem and upon these people, upon the scribes and the Pharisees and those who follow in their ways and who participate in persecuting the true prophets that God sends to them. When will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, from their point of view at that time, they were unable to separate those two. Obviously, they lived on the other side. We're living down here looking back And we realize that those two things can be separated by a great span of time, that they're not synonymous. If you were living then and there, you would expect, since you were looking for Messiah to come and throw out the hypocrites and throw out all the bad elements in society and restore the Davidic kingdom, the Solomonic kingdom, to its glory. And he talks about the destruction of the temple. Well, you would expect this destruction of the temple would lead automatically to the building of a new temple, a new city of Jerusalem, and the Messiah would reign there, and you would think that one would follow immediately the other. And this is undoubtedly what they were thinking. But now, in hindsight, looking back, we know that those two questions pertain to two very different times. The destruction of the temple did take place. It happened in AD 70, and it happened, by the way, within the generation, as Jesus said it would. But the coming of the Son of Man has not yet taken place. So we have two separate events. Is this one mine? Okay. So continuing, he goes on to say, and it says at verse 4, and Jesus said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. Now, he's about to set the theme for this chapter, and we're coming to the theme that I said that I feel that we have possibly overlooked in the past. Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You can take that two ways. You can take it to mean that many will come saying, I, Jesus, am the Christ, and deceiving many. Or you can take it to mean simply they'll come along and say, I am the Christ, not Jesus. And you've had false prophets from both stripes. Yeah, and I would say this verse is all encompassing and takes in any kind of false Christ, whether someone who says that Jesus is the Christ and yet they teach false doctrine, or someone who says that they are the Christ. And of course, that is a false doctrine, anyone else who would claim to be Christ. He says, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now notice what he says here. See that you are not troubled. Doesn't say be troubled. No, it says don't be troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Now sometimes you hear people, when they look at the wars and the rumors of the wars in this world today, and say, you see, all these things are signs pointing right to the end. We're right up to the end. He says, don't be troubled. These things are not signs, necessarily, that the end is near. Don't be troubled. He goes on to tell us why. He says, for nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are, he says, the beginning of sorrows, not the conclusion of the matter. And what does he mean here? What does this mean, beginning of sorrows? Some translations render this, these are only the birth pains. The birth pains. You know, those of you who have given birth, sometimes that can go on for a long time, can it? The birth pains. But the child is not delivered, perhaps for several hours later. I know some people have quick deliveries, but some do not. He says, these are the birth pains. Now, the end is not yet. You know, the child is not ready to be delivered. You're just seeing the birth pains. It's a good analogy. In verse 9 says, then, and I want you to know something about this word then in the Greek. It is an elusive word. It doesn't mean necessarily then following chronologically. It means more something like also or and. So you could render that and rather than then. So don't think that this is necessarily always a chronological sequence. Now, I think he does present chronology here, but in this case, when he says then, it doesn't. In each case he says then. There's verse 9 and verse 10 and down there in verse 11, also verse 22, you see the word then. It doesn't necessarily mean following immediately upon the previous event. It can also mean, it could just simply mean also. It says, also, or then, they will deliver you up to tribulation. Now, notice this word tribulation. The word tribulation there. They will deliver you up to tribulation. We often think of tribulation in terms of what is said in verse 21 about great tribulation. But this is the first tribulation he mentions here. And I believe this is the more, in one sense, the more important tribulation that is connected with the theme of this chapter. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation. This is tribulation upon the saints, and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended. What does that mean? You're going to get mad? No, it means they're going to fall away from the faith. That's the offense it's talking about here. They will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. That's always the pattern, isn't it? First you depart from the faith, and then you start to betray those who are a part of the faith, your former brothers and sisters, and you begin to hate them at that point, don't you? And so he's saying this is going to happen. What is he describing here for us, or for the disciples? He is saying, I am sending you out into a world of great tension and stress. But if that were not bad enough, guess what else you're going to contend with? Since it is a fallen world I'm sending you into, they're going to hate you. And not only that, but false prophets are going to rise, and there's going to be a powerful influence out there, obviously motivated by Satan the devil, to draw you away from the faith. And unfortunately, some will be drawn away from the faith. And this is what I'm sending you into. You have all this persecution, this hatred, and also this massive attempt motivated by Satan the devil to mislead and deceive you. You got to go out there and do this job in that environment. He says, and then many will be, as I said, many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Now, well, what is the purpose of this? You ever look at these things and say, well, where is God in all this? Why does he let these things go on? You know, we pray for each other. We hope that we have success in doing the work that we feel God has called us to do. And yet you see these things going on. And by the way, this is not something that only happened to the disciples in the first century. It did happen to them. Make no mistake about it. Evidently, everyone except John of the original apostles were martyred. And many of the other disciples were killed. And in the second century, we know that martyrdom took place. It was massive in the third and fourth centuries. And we know in the Middle Ages. But don't make any mistake about it, for it is still going on today in Islamic countries. Make no mistake about it, it went on in the communist countries and is going on in communist China today. Christians by the millions, and I'm not defining which one are the true Christians and the false, they all go together. They all suffer together. But by the millions, they're being persecuted. And there have been so many, there's been a holocaust of Christian persecution and martyrdom in our own time. And we know that now that some of this information is coming out. What was going on in communist countries, what is now going on in Islamic countries. It's part of the world. And Jesus says, this is the way it's going to be for those who follow me. They're going to be persecuted. They're going to be killed. But we understand that it's important to realize that Jesus draws here continually from the Old Testament prophets. Matthew 24 and the book of Daniel go together so well, and Jesus alludes to it. In fact, Daniel chapter 11 tells us why this persecution and martyrdom takes place. Let's go back to Daniel. I'll hold your place there. Go back to Daniel chapter 11, and let's see what Daniel says about this in describing similar events. In fact, some of the same events that Jesus is describing. And back in Daniel chapter 11, and beginning in verse 32, when he's talking about the king of the north and his blasphemies and his persecution against the people of God. Daniel chapter 11, verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame and by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. But many shall join with them by intrigue. And here we come to the main point here. And some of those of understanding shall fall. Why? Here's the answer. To refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end. Is for their own refinement, for their purification, for it is in this state of hostility, this environment of hostility against the people of God, that the people of God are refined and purified. Why? Because it is then that they must continually look to God as the source of their strength. And even though he lets these things happen, the process is like, well, gold being refined and in the fire, so the impurities can be skimmed off. And that's the way it is with the people of God. God lets these things happen to purify them and refine them. And Jesus is describing the process right here in Matthew 24, a process of refinement and purification. But in verse 11, once again, coming back to the theme, then, many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. This is what's going to be going on all along. So the major theme, here is watch out for deception. In this world of high tension, in this world where you are hated, there will be a massive effort to deceive you and lead you away from the faith. That's the theme of Matthew 24. It's not about which event matches which prophecy and how will you know when the coming of Christ is near. That's not what it's about. He goes on in verse 12, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Thank you. Because lawlessness will abound. And I take it to mean that this abounding lawlessness will affect the people of God. The love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. So this is the admonition here. Endure. Keep on enduring. Because you're in a world of high stress, a world that hates you, and are confronted with a massive effort to deceive you and lead you away from God. Now, guess what else is going to be going on at the same time? Guess what else will be happening at the same time? In spite of all the stress, in spite of all the hatred against the people of God, in spite of this massive effort to deceive, notice verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. So the gospel will be preached in the whole world. Now, was it preached in the world in the time of the apostles? Was it preached to the whole world? Well, hold your place here and go to Romans chapter 10. Romans chapter 10. Paul is talking about the preaching of the gospel. Verse 17, he says, so then faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. But I say, have they not heard? Yes, indeed. Their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So from the Apostle Paul's perspective, yep, the truth of God, the gospel, had gone out to the whole world. And you see, just because this is not something that's progressive necessarily, well, it went to part of the world now, back then, very little of the world later, and finally in the end time will go to the whole world. No, it's always gone out in some form or another. There's been times it's been suppressed, true, but the gospel has been preached somewhere in the world the whole time. It wasn't restored after 1850 years or something like that. No, it was already there. Maybe not in its fullness, but it was there. People were being converted. People were hearing the gospel, responding to it in repentance, and were faced and coming to face with this persecution and this world of stress that we see described here. So what I want to bring out here is that the apostles lived to see every one of the things described here. But it didn't end there. It continues to this day. Now, we come to a description of another tribulation. Again, I believe that the main theme of Matthew 24 is the tribulation upon the saints and the admonition on how to deal with it. That's the main theme. Now, kind of a parenthetical statement, because it's included in the question of the disciples and in the backdrop of what Jesus says to the scribes and Pharisees, is the destiny of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem that then was. Now, this is a little different from what you've heard in the past. I'm not establishing doctrine, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'm just throwing this out there as a possibility. It says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. And let those who are in Judea, not those who are in Tyler, Texas, not those who are in Shreveport, Louisiana, not those who are in Dallas, flee to the mountains. So what is this talking about? Something bad is going to happen in Judea. Okay? Now hold your place there. Let's go back and see. Well, my margin here, the marginal notes, the footnote refers to Daniel 11:31 and Daniel 12:11. Well, let's go to Daniel 9:26-27. Something's not mentioned in this margin that the editors put in the footnote. Daniel 9, and I want to give you a little brief background here on this chapter, what it's all about. This is the famous 70 weeks prophecy. I realize it's subject to a diversity of interpretations. I personally believe that in verse 26 that Messiah, the one is mentioned there, Messiah, that is Christ, not some anointed one, some other anointed one. I believe it's talking about Christ. I believe that this whole section is messianic, and many of Daniel's prophecies point directly to the coming of Christ. It says, after the 62 weeks, that's 69 weeks total, 69 weeks of years, says, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. So at some point after the 69 weeks of years, Messiah will be cut off. He's going to be killed. This is talking about the death of Christ. Now then, parenthetical statement follows, I believe. It says, and the people of the prince who is to come, that's not the Messiah, that's another prince, somebody else. The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with the flood until the end of the war. Desolations are determined. Keep these terms in mind. Desolations, abomination, and so on that we're going to see here. Close parenthesis. Okay, Messiah is to be cut off. And then parenthetical statement, but the people of the prince who is to come, they're going to destroy the sanctuary and so on. Now then, back to the subject. Messiah, who is cut off. Verse 27, and he, meaning Messiah, shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. I don't think this is talking about the prince there. He's talking about the Messiah. He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. That's 7 years. And in the middle of the week, in other words, after a 3.5-year ministry, in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offering. Metaphorically speaking, he didn't literally end the sacrificial system, but he became that ultimate sacrifice when he was offered as the Lamb of God. He was the sin offering. He was the Passover. He was all of it in one. And he fulfilled the whole sacrificial system. So in that sense, he brought an end to the sacrifices and offering. And then it says, now back to this prince who is to come, who will destroy the sanctuary. And on the wing of abominations, there's that word, shall one come who makes desolate. Abomination, desolation. Okay? Even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. So after Messiah is cut off, at some point, we read that on the wing of abominations shall one come who makes desolate. I believe this is talking about General Titus, who did come in AD 70 with his armies, besieged Jerusalem, and one of the most horrendous times in that city's history took place then. You can read about it in Josephus. Other sources cite Josephus and maybe other sources as to what happened. The city was besieged. No one could get out. The food supplies ran low. People actually turned to cannibalism. They would eat their own dead. That's how bad it got. It was terrible. People were killing each other for food and so on. It was a time of great tribulation that befell that city. And then finally the armies moved in. They destroyed the temple. And it was the end of those people as a nation, as for all practical purposes. Some moved back there later, and some there many Jews are there today. But for all practical purposes, it was the end of the system. The temple was gone. It was right at the heart and core of their worship and of their society. So back to Matthew chapter 24. He says, he speaks of the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place. I've always envisioned an idol standing in the temple, a rebuilt temple there in Jerusalem in the end time. I don't think he's talking about that. You compare Mark and Luke in their accounts, and one of them speaks of armies surrounding Jerusalem. If you just compare Mark 13, Luke 21 with Matthew 24, it speaks of armies surrounding Jerusalem. Though that's the source of the desolation that befalls Jerusalem. That's it. That is the abomination. So the army surrounding Jerusalem could be understood as the abomination of desolation. So let those who are in Judea or in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to take his clothes. In other words, when you see this abomination of desolation, when you see it beginning to happen, And of course, from A.D. 66 until 70, the Jewish wars, when that took place, people, you know, would have been wise to get out. In fact, the Christian community did. The Nazarenes did leave in about A.D. 66, and they got out before this happened. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Why? It's going to be so terribly difficult on them. Well, we know why. Just read Josephus' account on what happened in those years. And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath, because traveling is difficult. It was difficult. It's hard to get out on the Sabbath out of Jerusalem, hard to get out in the winter, difficult traveling and so on. For then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, known or ever shall be. Some people look on this as being great tribulation to befall the whole world, and it says here it's worse than anything before. I don't know how anything could be worse than an Noachian flood, do you? When everybody gets drowned? No, I don't think so. I can't be as far, if you want to look at it locally, I don't see how it could be any worse than what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah when fire and brimstone came pouring out of heaven and everybody was cremated instantly. This is talking about of the various tribulations that have befallen Jerusalem. It says this one is going to be the worst. And it's in the backdrop of what he said in Matthew chapter 23, that on you, on this generation, shall come the blood of all the prophets from Abel down to the son of Zechariah, or son of Berechiah, Zechariah the son of Berechiah. So that's what he's talking about here, I believe. I don't think this is talking about an end time tribulation. Understand, there will be an end time tribulation. No question about it. You read about that in the book of Revelation. You're reading about it right here. But this section from verse 15 to verse 21, which describes the great tribulation to befall Jerusalem, I do not believe this is about the end time. And again, if I'm wrong on this, well, I'll come to understand it hopefully somewhere along the way. This is talking about, I think, in my presence, if you want to call it speculation, is talking about what happened to Jerusalem in A.D. 70. And it was the worst thing that's ever happened in that city. And Christ tells us why it happened. Some people would call Christians anti-Semites for holding this view. That's not true at all. He tells us it's because they persecuted the people he sent to them. Now, verse 22. I'm not sure that verse 22 is talking about the same tribulation mentioned in verse 21. It could be talking about that, or it could be going back to verse 9. In other words, if you look at verses 15 through 21 as a parenthetical insert, a block that is inserted in the overall text, then verse 22 could refer back to the tribulation that is the theme of the chapter, or a part of the theme of the chapter, that will befall the saints. It says, and unless those days were shortened, no flesh should be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Now, if the elect had already gotten out of Jerusalem, then maybe this is talking about the persecution of the world in general on the saints. But then on the other hand, I see how it could go either way. There's no issue one way or the other. It says, now here we see that there's, after this tribulation period, we see Christ saying something that allows for a very long period of time, an indefinite period. He says, then, again, and, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. I take it to mean that this is after this great tribulation on Jerusalem. For false Christs, back to that theme again, false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. It's not saying it's impossible to deceive the elect, by the way. It says they will deceive them if it's possible. They'll do everything possible to deceive the elect, in other words. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. In other words, you can't miss it. It's not in a secret place. It's going to be visible for everyone to see. So he's saying here, don't look for some secret sign or some secret that only the initiated know, and that's what he's talking about. That's what did happen in the early centuries of Christianity. He's saying, when it happens, it's going to be visible to everybody. when the sun rises in the east in the morning, there's no question that it's day. It's daylight. Everybody knows it. You can see it. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles, it should be vultures, will be gathered together. In other words, if there's a carcass laying out there in the woods someplace, everybody's going to know where it is. You know how? The vultures circling overhead. It's going to be visible to everybody. And then he says, verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days. What tribulation is he talking about here? Is he talking about the tribulation on Jerusalem, mentioned in verse 21, or described in verses 15 through 21? Or is he talking about that tribulation that will characterize the entire age from Pentecost to the Parousia? I personally think that that's what he's talking about. And he's saying that there is coming a time when that tribulation against the saints, the persecution of the saints, is going to come to a close. And then it's going to be time for Messiah to appear in the heavens. It says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Now, some commentators refer to Isaiah 13, verses 9 and 10. I'm not going back there, which describes the fall of Babylon, and it uses similar language. Also, the fall of Edom in Isaiah chapter 34 and verse 4, and of Samaria in Amos chapter 8, verse 10, and of Egypt in Ezekiel 32 and verses 7 and 8. And they say, see, Jesus is simply using the language of the prophets. This is literary. It should not be understood literally. And it's just a way of saying the lights are going out in Israel or in, you know, Jerusalem. But I think that's a forced interpretation. I think it's forced. I think it's an unnatural reading. I take it to mean that there will be literal heavenly signs. The sun will be darkened because Jerusalem's already fallen, after all. He says, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. That was the other question, wasn't it? When will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? Notice he doesn't say, now here there are going to be a bunch of signs, plural, no. He says, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Here's that sign. Finally, you're going to get your sign. When? When you look up and see him coming. Or just right before. The sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Whatever that sign is, perhaps some heavenly display that just precedes the coming of Christ, whatever it is, it's going to make a lot of people scared. The tribes of the earth will mourn, it says. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. I don't believe that this is an allusion, a reference back to Daniel 7 in verses 13 and 14, which describes in similar terms Christ going to the Ancient of Days. It says, coming in the clouds of heaven. Some people say that, and they say that this happened back in when Christ ascended. No, this is talking about the end, when they will see him coming from heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Some people take this to mean angels mean to be messengers. The sound of the trumpet is the preaching of the gospel. The messengers will go out and gather the elect. In other words, form the church. That's not what he's talking about here. I think that's an unnatural reading. I think it means exactly what he says. That he'll send out his angels. Not preachers, not human messengers, but these spirit beings. With a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from the one end of heaven to the other. You know, those who have been persecuted all this time, those who have been killed, they'll be finally gathered together. And he says, now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that the summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, what things? He's not talking about the coming of the Son of Man himself. He's not talking about this final sign of the Son of Man in heaven. He's talking about all the things preceding that. When you see all these things, know that it is near. What is near? The parousia. That means the coming of Christ. The parousia is near. At the doors. Now, there's something we need to understand, though. The disciples who lived then and there saw every one of these things. No wonder they had reason to expect the coming of Messiah in their lifetimes, the return of Christ, that is, because they saw every one of these things. Many of them lived to see the fall of Jerusalem. They were there in AD 70. Some of the books of the Bible were written just a few years before Jerusalem fell, before the temple was destroyed. And apparently some books were written after the temple was destroyed, the best we can tell. So he says, when you see all these things, it would include the destruction of Jerusalem, but the disciples saw it all. They saw the false prophets. What do you think the epistles are about? Why all the epistles? Are they just nice little religious writings? No, Paul was dealing with real problems. Read 1 Corinthians sometimes. It was one heresy after another Paul was encountering and combating. Read 2 Peter. Read the book of Jude. These things took place. The false prophets did come. They did deceive some in an attempt to deceive and lead away God's people as much as possible. All these things happened. Now, verse 34 says, assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. And indeed, all those things took place right there in that generation, including the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, it was approximately 40 years. If that's a Bible generation, some say it is. Approximately 40 years after Christ spoke these words, Jerusalem fell. So all these things happened in that generation. However, the thing we need to understand is just because they all happened doesn't mean that they haven't continued to happen since then. They have. They have. The fall of Jerusalem is behind us now, but we still have persecution. We still have the tribulation upon the saints. It's going on today, and it will go on until God brings it to an end, apparently just before the second coming of Jesus Christ. So all of these things have happened. All of these things continue to happen. That's how you can look at verses 33 and 34 and realize that he was talking about that generation. You know, some people look at verse 34 and say, surely I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away. They say, well, that's the generation when you see these things happen in the end time. That's forced. Now, if you were standing there as a disciple of Jesus and hearing him say, truly I say to you, so listen, I'm telling you the truth, that's strong emphasis. This generation will not pass till all these things take place. You would know what that meant. No question about it. So these things are going to happen in my lifetime, or at least in the lifetime of this present generation. And that is what it meant, clearly. And those things did happen, but they continue to happen. And there's more to happen in the future. It says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. And then he says, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as in the days of Noah, as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. This does not mean that they were gluttonous and that they were marrying the wrong people. That's not what he's talking about. He's saying that life went on as usual until Noah entered the ark. And he's saying in the end, in the days of the coming of the Son of Man, oh yeah, you have a world of stress. We have it today, don't we? Look at what's going on in the world. We fear terrorism, don't we? We know it's going to happen again. We know it could be much worse this time. We know some of those weapons of mass destruction that some say don't exist might turn up in some of our cities, don't we? So we live in a time of high stress, and yet life goes on, doesn't it? People marry, are given in marriage, eating and drinking. You know, just life goes on. And that's what he's saying here. In this time, throughout this whole period, Pentecost to the Parousia, life will go on. And in the days of the coming of the Son of Man, life will be going on as usual. And that's why it's going to shock. It'll surprise so many people when it happens. He goes on saying, did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also the coming of the Son of Man shall be. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other left. What is he talking about here? Some have suggested that when armies invade this country or other countries, that some will be taken away and some left. I think this is simply referring back to what he said in verse 31. He'll send forth his angels and gather his elect. So in the days, he's talking about the days of the coming of the Son of Man, not the preceding tribulation periods. I think, you know, any tribulation period. He's talking about the days of the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one taken and one left. In other words, one is gathered up by the angels that are sent forth, back in verse 31. He says, watch therefore, in other words, be vigilant, be always prepared, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allow his house to be broken into. He would have been vigilant. Therefore, you also be ready. That's what it means to watch. For the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. And then he gives a parable of two servants, the faithful servant and an evil servant. He said, who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? He's not talking about somebody who's been made master over the church, nothing like that. It's just simply a parable. It applies to any of us. Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. You know, a faithful servant, the master comes and sees he's doing his job. He gives him more responsibility. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, in an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So it's back to that same theme again, isn't it? If he begins to beat his fellow servants, in other words, if he's given over to the deception of the false prophets, and he becomes a part of that group who betrays one another and hates one another, then this is what's going to happen to him. You see the same theme running throughout Matthew 24. This is the theme of the Olivet Discourse. It's encouragement, it's exhortation for the people of God to remain faithful in spite of the things that they see. So we could go on into chapter 25, and you see this theme continues in several parables. But we'll stop it there in Matthew 24, and I'd encourage you to read, compare Mark 13 and Luke 21. I do believe that we find two questions answered here. One is the question concerning the fall of Jerusalem. The other is the question concerning the sign of the coming of the Son of Man. And basically what he's saying concerning the sign of the coming of the Son of Man, he's not saying when you see wars and rumors of wars and pestilences and earthquakes and all these things, get ready because it's coming. He says, no, this is the birth pains, but the end is not yet. And he finally tells his disciples that there will come a time when they will see the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And when that happens, next thing they know, the Son of Man appears. And he sends forth his angels, and he gathers his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. I believe this particular approach, this way of looking at Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse in general, enables us to make sense of all the verses in this chapter and in the other chapters. Rather than have to force interpretations on the meaning of this generation and adopt other forced interpretations, I believe we can see simply he's answering two questions. And from our perspective, we can see that these two questions pertain to two very different times. One, the destruction of the temple and the fall of Jerusalem, and the other, the days of the coming of the Son of Man. But the admonition is, the exhortation here is, we live in a world of stress. We live in a world that will hate us if we follow Christ. We don't see so much of it in this country, but we see more of it, don't we? And we will see more in the days ahead, no doubt. We haven't caught up with the rest of the world yet, but I think we're moving in that direction. But though you live in a world of stress, in a world where they hate you, and a world that is filled with false prophets who are trying to deceive you, go on and do what I have sent you out to do. For I am refining you, I am purifying you, and I am preparing you for my coming. And when I come, you'll be among those who rise to meet the Lord when the trumpet sounds.